This is Audible.
Phoenix Books presents Questions and Answers on Conversations with God, written by Neil Donald Walsh. This unabridged performance by Neil Donald Walsh features music composed and performed by Michael Misch. This audiobook is copyright 2014, Phoenix Books. It has been digitally remastered from the original audio literature sound recording.
Everybody in the world has questions about life and how it works. Everybody in the world also has the answers. Not everybody in the world knows this. I certainly didn't. I looked everywhere for answers, but within. I listened to parents, family, and friends, teachers, pastors, leaders, authors, philosophers, anyone and everyone I thought might have something to say. Then I turned to God. I asked a pile of questions, and I finally got answers. Those responses form the published trilogy known as Conversations with God. They've also led to more questions, not just from me, but from many of the millions of readers of those books. The most important answer I received was that I no longer had to ask questions. All of the answers, God said, are inside of me. All I have to do is go within. That's all any of us have to do. Go within and meet the Creator. It's okay, of course, to ask questions of others. Sometimes it's useful, and often it's very valuable, to get input from another part of God. It's good to remember, however, that no part of God hears the message that is meant for you more clearly than the part of God that is within you. So listen to advice, seek counsel, consider input, but always weigh it carefully against the guidance from your own inner voice. If you elevate outside input to the level of absolute truth, you announce and declare that you are not the source. This would be a lie about you. Now, these might seem to be strange things to say in a book of questions, but actually, they're exactly the right things to say. I don't want you to think that the answers found here are any more authoritative than the answers found in your own heart. That is where the wisdom lies. That is where the real truth resides. Sometimes the greatest value of input from another source is that it opens you to your own truth. Certainly that's the intention here. That's why I take the time in each issue of my personal newsletter to readers to answer a handful of the more than 300 letters a week that I receive from people all over the world asking about the Conversations with God material and how to apply it in their lives. And that's why we've selected and placed in this book some of the most interesting Q&As from 5 years' worth of those newsletters. When you hear these letters, don't be surprised if you find a bit of yourself here. All of us, after all, are asking the same questions. All of us are looking in our own way and from our own perspective at the same issues. So what you're experiencing right now is not a book at all. This is a mirror. I invite you to gaze deeply into it. Look to see what's being reflected here. It might just be the path to your own highest truth. I love questions. They make my mind expand. And the more difficult the questions, the better I like it. That's why I loved answering the questions in this book. They include some of the most challenging inquiries I've ever received on the Conversations with God material, reflecting the passions, frustrations, interests, and curiosities of some wonderfully engaging and courageous people. Throughout the book, I've tried to categorize these inquiries by topic. Some letter writers, however, clearly had no intention of limiting themselves to one subject per letter. I thought of taking these multiple topic inquiries and breaking them into segments, putting the various segments into more definable categories. But in the end, I felt that this would just have taken a lot of the steam out of them. These questions are juicy precisely because they are compound and complex. Life, of course, is like that too. So here they are, questions that offer a real slice of life. Real questions about real life from real people.
My name is Penny. And the only word that seems to sum up how I felt when I read your book was, wow. Neil, these are the questions that your book has raised for me. Number one, I still don't understand why people in relationships, especially families, constantly hurt each other, and the relationships go up and down. Is it karma being worked out from past lives? Number two, in your book, God says the color white does not mean without color. It means color inclusive. Does this apply to race? Does this mean that a white person represents all of the other races combined? As an African American, I'm curious why God created different races, and his her thoughts on the current race issues. I know that no one race is superior to another, but I just need to hear it from God, though I already know. Number 3, are you sure there is no devil? Who was Lucifer? There is evil in this world, but is the source solely man? Is there no bogeyman out there? Do you realize if we truly believe this, how much fear this releases, and what potential it shows we have? Number 4. How do I release my great level of fear about everything? Number 5. Is God a he or a she? Which is it? And what should we call her? Does she mind? Does she even care? I could never have asked such a facetious question before reading your book. Number 6. Are there any good organized religions that incorporate most of God's true messages? I was raised Catholic, but left the church when I started my search for truth. I don't know what to label myself now, except child of God. I totally believe in Jesus, because he answered me time and time again. So I suppose that makes me a Christian of sorts. I believe in a lot of New Age thought, but not all. So I might be a Christian New Age mystic. Smile. And finally, number 7, how can I talk to the goddess? Will she talk to me, even with all my fears and doubts? How do I connect with her? This sounds crazy, but I want to hear her say she loves me too, and feel her love. I want to spend my life helping others that are less fortunate, but I need to ask her what area I should help out in. AIDS, homelessness, kids, where? Can you help me? I hope that you can feel the sincerity of my message, and I have faith that you will answer me. With much love and thanks, Penny.
My wonderful, wonderful Penny, of course I'm going to answer you. And what a letter! I could write a book from this one. Let's take your questions in order. Number 1. People hurt each other in relationships because they do. They do it because they do, Penny. There's no larger reason for it, such as working out karma from past lives and so forth. It's just something that happens. It's part of life. Nobody hurts another out of villainous intent. Remember these 2 important teachings, Penny. No one acts inappropriately given their model of the world. All attack is a call for help. People hurt each other because they want something they think they can't have or have something they don't want. They're in one of the above 2 conditions and they don't know what to do about it. They think that the only method of getting their way, having their desires met, is to hurt another. They don't have to do this, but they don't know that. They don't understand how to have what they want or not have what they don't want without hurting one another. The problem is education, not intent. Greet each instance of hurt with compassion and love. Compassion for others' lack of understanding. We've all been there at one time or another. Love for others' humanness and their attempts, however apparently misguided, to solve their dilemmas and keep on trying to make their lives work. We're engaged here in a process of becoming, of creating, of being. Some of us are being more than others. That's just how it is. That's what I call isness. It's just what's true. Accept that with a smile. Embrace that with love in your heart. Understand deeply that no one wants to hurt you. They simply do it inadvertently, or perhaps indeed on purpose, because they know no other way to have the experience they desire. The next time someone hurts you, ignore the hurt and go to the only question which matters. What do you want or need so badly that you feel you have to hurt me to get it? You can ask this question silently in your heart. Or if you have a particularly open and honest relationship with the other person, you can actually address the question verbally. Try it sometime. It's a terrific argument stopper. It's a terrific abuse ender. What do you want or need so badly that you feel you have to hurt me to get it? What is it you want to have or feel right now? Is there a way I can help you to have that without giving up who I am? Even asked silently, in your heart, these questions can change the moment so dramatically, so immediately, so powerfully, that you won't even know what happened. And your partner in this dance will wonder what new level of mastery you've gone to. There's much more to say on this subject. Okay, Penny, let's look at your second question that God asks about the color white and race and all of that. See, I can't speak for God here, Penny. And while I've said that, let me make that statement about everything that appears in these letters. These letters are not an extension of the book Conversations with God. That I'm not presently at the level where I can sit down any time I wish and begin receiving the kind of information that came through me for that book at my whim. As I explained in Book 1, those writings took a year to come through, another year for Book 2, even longer for Book 3 and Friendships with God. So I don't claim the letter you're holding in your hand to be a direct channeling from God or inspired writing, a term I do use to describe the CWG trilogy. These letters to readers reflect what I've gotten out of the trilogy myself. They're my understandings based on over 3 years of taking dictation for the trilogy. I want to be clear about that. I want to get as far away as I can from any paradigm which suggests that what Neil says is what God says. It would be a huge, I mean a monumental, mistake to create such a paradigm around me. Now to your questions on race, Penny. I don't believe that the so-called white race represents all other races combined, but rather it's simply one more offshoot of the mother race, with skin pigmentations and physical characteristics that are nothing more or less than the result of biological survival imperatives at the early stages of human development, based upon conditions existent for the various peoples on the planet at that time. These races continue to proliferate as the result of the hereditary gene pool, which was formulated at that time and then passed on through succeeding generations. As to why God created different races, I don't think God sat down one pleasant morning and said, "I'll create many different races, each of a different color and characteristic." I think God simply allows the process of life to exist, and that it is out of that process, the process of life, that all things are created, not just races, but volcanoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, human errors and mistakes, travesties of justice, goodness, and mercy, you name it. I don't think that God sits up there somewhere and creates these terms and conditions of the human experience one by one, or even all at once with a single master stroke. I think that God simply created life itself, as we have defined it in the physical universe, with an extraordinary set of laws which govern the who, what, where, and why of things. The discipline of science is man's attempt to uncover those laws, to understand them, then to work with them to produce desired results. There's even a spiritual movement called religious science, which is based on the thought that God's laws are understandable by man and may be used with predictable and consistent results. As to God's thoughts on the current race issues, I don't know about that. You'd have to ask her. I do have an idea, however, of how God might answer that question. I believe God might say, "Human beings have exhibited an extraordinary penchant for taking anything which renders them different and allowing that to separate them. You've created a species which does not tolerate differences very well, and it is this single human failing which has led to the massive misery which visits your planet. If you could just get over your differences and stop seeing them as that which separates you, if you could just focus with love on those aspects of your being which you hold in common, the desire for peace, the wish to love and be loved, the hope for a life of dignity in a world of choices which are free, the yearning for an opportunity to each rise to your highest potential, and the earnest and unending urging within you to express the very best that you are, if you could see these as the aspects of humanity that matter, encouraging and fostering, nurturing and empowering them, rather than empowering your fear and anger and hatred and distrust over your differences, then the whole human experience would change forever, and you'd be in the paradise I had originally created for you." As I interpret CWG, Penny, I also believe God would say, "My singular treasure, Penny, of course it's true that no single race is superior to another. Superiority of any kind does not exist in ultimate reality, for you are all superior, and thus none more superior than another. This is what is meant by the teaching that you were all created, all of you, in the image and likeness of God. This is what is meant by the profound statement upon which your very nation was built, that all men are created equal. Finally, I believe that God would make one closing and extraordinary statement. It is also true, Penny, that not even I am superior to you. When you understand this, you will know the greatest gift of God, that each of you is endowed with the wisdom and the power and the perfection and the love of that which is God itself, for you are what I am. This is necessarily true, because what I am is all there is. The only difference between us, Penny, is that I know this, and you do not. This is what I truly believe God would say, my new friend, and who is to deny that he has just said it to you? Now. Okay, Penny, now to your third question. Are you sure there's no devil? Yes, I am sure. For greater clarity on this subject, reread pages 14, 24 to 25, 51, 53, 61, 85, 154, 196, and 204 of CWG Book 1. I could add nothing here that would be more eloquent. Now, Penny, you've also asked how to release your great level of fear over everything. Well, you know, Franklin Roosevelt said it with remarkable clarity. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. You'll release yourself from fear, Penny, when you realize that there's nothing to be afraid of. What's the worst that can happen in any situation? Well, that you'll die, of course. That's about the worst, right? And that might just be the best thing that's ever happened to you. People who have died and returned to their body, people who have NDEs, near-death experiences, fear nothing. Did you know that? They fear nothing. And do you know why? Because they've gotten very clear that there's nothing to fear, not even death. See, fear is an announcement that you don't believe in God. For if a God exists, why would he want anything less than what is best for you? Yet if you have experiences that you judge to be less than the best, who is at cause in the matter, God? Or could it be you? Yet do not denounce fear, Penny, and neither condemn it. For fear is merely the opposite of love, and without it, love could not exist in your reality. Therefore, love your fear. You might even say, love it to death. Now, Penny, your fifth question was intriguing. Is God a he or a she? Well, the answer is, God is neither a he nor a she. God has no form which is permanent, save that form which you would call formlessness. Yet God can and does take whatever form and whatever shape God knows you will understand. And no, God does not care what you call him, as long as you do call her. This is to say, don't ignore him. This is not because she's lonely and needs your company. It's because God's greatest pleasure is to be there for you in as large a way as you will permit, in whatever form you will allow yourself to recognize. Do you recognize God in the form of a flower? How about an inspired melody? The whisper of the wind, the softness of the new fallen snow. How about the face of your persecutor? Do you recognize God in the person of your villain? If you do not, you do not know God at all, nor understand her ways, nor have any idea at all what he's up to. Only when you see God everywhere you look, everywhere, do you see God at all. This is a difficult concept for most people to grasp. This is a very hard truth for many to accept, yet it is true. It is the greatest truth ever told. All right now, Penny, you asked me if there are any good organized religions that incorporate most of God's true messages. Well, it's difficult for me to be anything but purely subjective on this question, so I'm tempted not to answer it at all, because who cares what Neil Donald Walsh thinks? The important thing is what you think. Check out the world's religions. Read up on them. Go to a few churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, and houses of prayer. See what you think. Feel what you feel. The truth will be made clear to you. Now, while there are good things in most every religion, I want to remind you of what CWG says on this topic. It says that religion is man's attempt to explain the inexplicable, and that in this, it does not do a very good job. I agree with CWG's wisdom on this. I think there's a vast difference between religion and spirituality. I seek to practice spirituality, not religion. Still, if I were looking for a good organized religion, here's what I would seek and here's what I would avoid. I love ritual, and I also love factual information which helps me to understand things. So many of the churches today offer a preponderance of either one or the other, either explaining everything about God so factually that it becomes all too dry, or moving toward the experience of God so ritualistically that there is only airy-fairiness and nothing to engage the mind. So I look for a church which combines and mixes the factual and the ritual, thus touching and allowing me to experience all the parts of me, body, mind, and spirit. I also know that God exists and acts in, as, and through everyone and everything. So I'm uncomfortable in churches or groups which tend to deify one particular being, however holy, over others. I believe that other being-centered religions can be dangerous, because they offer a temptation to substitute the holy being around which the movement revolves for one's own holiness, one's own truth, one's own divinity. And to that degree, they delay the spiritual quest and betray the spiritual experience to which life invites all of us. For this reason, I avoid other being-centered churches, where individual thinking and individual experience is virtually not allowed if it so much as questions, much less contradicts, the teachings of the holy other. I know that God is neither a man nor a woman, neither black nor white, but takes whatever form God chooses, for whatever purpose God declares. I also know that God finds no one race, sex, color, or type of human being superior to or more holy than any other. So I look for churches and spiritual organizations that honor the God and the Goddess, that elevate and give equal opportunity to men and women, and that deny no one the chance to create holy ritual and perform sacred service as priests, bishops, ministers, teachers, and leaders. Penny, I also know that God speaks directly to and through human beings in this day and time, and has in all days and times. And so for this reason, I avoid any church, sect, or philosophy that holds that man cannot have direct, immediate, two-way communication with God, but insists, rather, that an intermediary or particular process is required, which just happens to be the intermediary or process around which that religion or philosophy is formed. I know that there is no one right way to approach God, experience God, love God, and bring the direct experience of God into one's life. And because I know this, I dismiss at once any church, religion, group, sect, cult, or clan that claims and asserts that its teachings are the only true teachings, and that its way is the one true way, and that any other teaching or way, no matter how sincere or well-intended, can only lead to damnation and the angry, unmerciful curse of the very God to whom one is reaching out. These are my personal guidelines, Penny, and they don't have to be yours. The difficulty of these guidelines is that they tend to eliminate virtually every organized religion on the face of the earth. So there you have it. And now, Penny, to your last question, which was, how can I talk to the God or the Goddess anytime, any place? You can do that, of course, directly. You do speak to him with every thought, every word, every idea, every choice, every action. Did you hear what I just said? I said you speak to God right now. With every thought, word, idea, choice, or action. You cannot not talk to God. And God talks back to you, by the way, every day in a million ways. She may even be talking to you now. So listen. Look. I love you, Penny. Finally, as to how you can find a way to serve others through and with your life, see Bringers of the Light, a wonderful booklet that's made available through our foundation. And God bless you, Penny. You're a marvelous work and a wonder.
Dear Mr. Walsh, I have three questions that came up for me while reading your book. Number one, there has been of late a surge of literature about and interest in angels. What do you think or feel about this subject? Number two, God seemed to have some pretty strong feelings about eating animals, but it seems to me people have been eating animals as far back as the caveman. And even animals eat animals. So when did it become inadvisable? Number three. Lastly, I was really shaken after reading page 190 in CWG, where it indicated that annual physicals and use of medicine are something we should engage in. Now back on page 49, it mentioned that the medical establishment opposes new treatments, even miracles. I've always felt that by walking into a doctor's office, I was giving up the belief that my body is capable of healing itself. In addition, by going into an atmosphere where sickness is a business and a very strong belief, I was creating a situation for myself in which I would actually make myself sick. Going to a doctor is saying, I am sick, thereby creating the physical reality of sickness. And what about the drugs they give you? What about radiation therapy? Now, there's a hell of an idea. Let's prescribe something that's going to make people sick as hell and probably won't work anyway.
Why not help people find out why they came down with cancer instead? Janet, Lichfield, Connecticut.
Dear Janet, I think angels are very real, very present, and very wonderful. As to your second question, God has no preference in the matter of whether we eat animal flesh or not. He simply notices that we have a preference for living long and healthy lives and offers his advice on how to do that. Incidentally, when noticing that even animals eat animals, it should be pointed out that animals eaten by animals are often still alive or have just been killed and have probably never been injected with chemicals, preservatives, hormones, and so forth, which is more than can be said about the long-dead animals that most humans eat. Well, now to your third question, Janet, about physicals and whether we should have them once a year and so forth. Let's look at your treatise on medical doctors, one statement at a time. First, you said that you've always felt that by walking into a doctor's office, you are giving up the belief that your body is capable of healing itself. Of course, if you've always felt that way, and if you refuse to change how you've always felt, there you have it. Can't be any other way. On the other hand, you can decide not to feel that way. When I walk into a doctor's office, I walk in with the feeling that my body can heal itself, and that a doctor can sometimes be of help. And by taking an airplane to Dubuque, I'm in no way invalidating my ability to get to Dubuque by car. You see what I'm telling you? I'm simply choosing another way, perhaps even a faster way, of getting where I want to go. In life, Janet, making one choice does not invalidate the other. Choosing chocolate doesn't make vanilla wrong. Unless, of course, it does. All depends how you feel about it. Next, you said that when you went into a doctor's office, you were going into an atmosphere where sickness is a business. See, I think differently. I see a doctor's office as a place where the people there are saying healing is the business. Therefore, I don't see myself as creating a situation for myself in which I would actually make myself sick, but rather creating a situation for myself in which I would actually make myself well. I'm not willing to dismiss all drug intervention on the basis of someone's idea that drugs are no good. And I know too many people, Janet, who have greatly benefited from radiation therapy, including some very close to me, to dismiss that avenue out of hand. Now you ask, why not help people find out why they came down with cancer instead? Well, I agree with you. The question should be asked. But the person who already has cancer may want some additional assistance. Yet the point of CWG, Janet, is that you create your own reality. There's no contradiction in the book on this point. If you see or perceive other contradictions, always go with your deepest feeling, your own deepest truth. I'm not here to talk you out of your truth, but to assist in leading you to it.
Dear Neil, after reading the closing of your book and down to the ending of the last letter of your name, there were chills that came all over me, and then even more chills. So I give you thanks for being the messenger you were meant to be. Above all, I give thanks for this book to be written, for I too had many of the same questions you did. I have even more regarding the psychic world. My questions are, 1, how do you become psychic? 2, is there a danger, as they say, for bad spirits to enter you if you do not put the white light around you? 3, in Mary Summer Rain's book, Spirit Song, she meditates and is in a place they call hell. If there is no hell, what place has she experienced? 4, what purpose is the white light? 5, is it okay to ask a psychic for information about yourself and loved ones who have passed away? Or should we develop this ability ourselves? Love and happiness, Stephanie, Corona, California.
Boy, Stephanie, your questions invited an entire book. Actually, question 1 is covered in the CWG trilogy. Let me give you some quick reference data here. First, there's no way to become psychic. You already are. Everyone is psychic. There's no way not to be. Being psychic is part of our nature. It's our sixth sense. And recognizing this is the first step toward actively utilizing one's psychic ability. So here's the short version of the answer to your first question. Recognize, acknowledge, accept, and own your own psychic sense as a natural gift. Use your psychic sense every day by paying attention to it. Listen to your intuition about things and act on that as often as you can. Don't think when you get a psychic hit, just act. Do it. The more you act quickly on your psychic hits, the more you'll learn to trust them, as you find that acting on them brings affirmative results. Listen to feelings. Feelings are the language of the soul. If it feels like you should be doing or not doing something, listen to that. That's your psyche, your soul, talking to you. Also, give yourself permission to be wrong. It'll take a while to separate genuine intuitive wisdom from the mishmash of thoughts, ideas, fears, and so forth running around inside your head. Don't give up if you start following your feelings or giving in to your first impulse and finding yourself wrong for having done that. Grant yourself some leeway here, especially at first. The next step is to say the first thing that comes to your head. Whenever you get a hit, say it out loud. Put yourself out there in that way. You'll find that you're blurting out to others some of the most astonishing stuff. And some of those others will look at you in shock that you could have come up with such insight and information. Now here's another rule. Never use psychic gifts for personal aggrandizement or enrichment. That's very much akin to using sex for personal power or manipulation, instead of the pure and loving purpose for which it was intended. I have found that psychic gifts go away if they're used to attract a shower of attention or money. Use psychic gifts only in the service and for the benefit of others. I realize that this is my personal construction, but after all, it is me you're asking. Now to your second question, Stephanie, about danger of bad spirits entering you and all that. I don't believe in the often talked about danger of bad spirits, and so, of course, they don't enter me. I have to laugh at that because I really don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg. I mean, I genuinely don't know what happened initially, the belief or the experience. I do think, and the CWG trilogy has led me to further believe, that our thought about a thing creates our reality of that thing. So if you carry a thought that, A, there are such things as bad spirits, and B, putting the white light around you protects you from them, well, then that'll be your experience. As a result, you won't be bothered by bad spirits any more than I am. Now, in your third question, Stephanie, you asked me about Mary Summerrain's book. Well, I haven't read the book, Spirit Song, although my wife has. I know Mary Summerrain, however, to be a very honest person, extremely true to herself, and so I'm sure that she has the precise experience that she's written about. My own CWG3 talks much more about this experience of hell, which many people believe in, and which some people, such as Mary, have apparently had, if only through brief, revealing visitations. What place has Mary experienced? Good question. You'd have to ask her. In my own view of things, which is, by the way, worth nothing, actually, since this was Mary's experience, I would speculate that she had visited a place created deep in her personal belief system. That is to say, her personal reality. For in my construction, belief systems are reality. This place may be so deep in most people that they've forgotten when they originally created it, or even that they did. In fact, they would swear to you that they didn't, and that it's real, that it is reality. And indeed, for them, it is. Hell is simply not a reality for me, so I don't go there, nor am I afraid of going there, nor, therefore, will I ever go there, for there is no there to which to go, you see? Of course, I could be all wrong about this, so I'd be careful about adopting my belief system if I were you. Now, let's see, your fourth question. What purpose is the white light? What do you wish to be the purpose of the white light? Do you not see that things do not have a purpose intrinsically? This is the hardest part of what has been revealed to me for most people to understand. A thing has no purpose in and of itself, Stephanie. Every purpose for anything is given to it by you and me. We decide what a thing means and what purpose a thing shall have. And before we decide, a thing has no purpose at all. Now, it's true that some things have already been assigned a purpose by those who have come before us and by the collective agreement of their offspring. We all understand the purpose of a fork, for instance, or a shovel. So we agree on some things, collectively, and thus make life workable. But there are some things we can't agree on, no matter how many people have come before with an idea about it. What is the purpose of sex, for example, or of power? What is the purpose of illness, or of God? What is the purpose of music, or of art? They're still debating that one in PTAs and school board meetings all over America. Some say music and art has no purpose and therefore no place in public schools. Others vehemently disagree. So you see, the white light has no purpose. It's purposeless, as is all of life. What is the purpose of your life? You decide. Oh, and while you're about it, decide what the purpose of the white light is. All right, now to your last question. Is it okay to ask a psychic for information about yourself and so forth? Well, of course it's okay. Why wouldn't it be? At least that's my opinion. Now someone else may tell you differently. Don't you see there's nothing but point of view here that dictates this? Whatever point of view you adopt, so too will it be for you. Now, do you think God has a rule about this? Wrong. God has no rules about anything. That's the whole message of the CWG books.
Dear Neil, number one, why is time never mentioned in your book or the Bible? Number two, when is prayer answered, after 2 months or a year? Of the I Am you say moves the universe, when is prayer answered? In days, weeks, years, and who decides when? Number three, the book of Job in the Bible, was that made up? Did Job bring all that misery upon himself? Did he create it himself? Number four, just what books, verses in the Bible are true? And number five, in Conversations with God, pages 63, 205 through 208, God said sex is great, wonderful, do it, have fun. Yet on page 49, he says we on earth are doing nothing to stop 40,000 people a day from dying of hunger, while we bring 50,000 people a day into the world to begin new life. Seems to be a small problem here. When you have sex, fun, wonderful, powerful, exciting, etc., you create those 50,000 new lives. He or you mention nothing of birth control, abortions to stop these lives from entering, let alone the diseases we now have. Neither is age mentioned with regard to enjoying sex. Is there one? Is 10 too young? 15? 18? Please don't get me wrong. I love sex. It's great. But you, or God, left yourself wide open on this one.
Your questions tell me that CWG succeeded at what every book hopes and seeks to do, make people stop and think. Remember now, this is me answering. I don't represent these answers to be replies direct from deity without a filter. So if we can agree on that, I'll give you my impressions on all this based on what I've learned these past years as a result of the dialogue. Your first question has to do about time and the Bible and all that, and I tell you, Marge, I can't tell you why time is never mentioned in the Bible. Although I can tell you it's not the only enormous component of life experience which has been ignored in that book after it was revised and finally released. I can tell you that it is mentioned, however, quite extensively in Conversations with God Book 2. So if the Bible lets you down, pick up CWG. All right, Marge, now in your second question, you asked about when prayer is answered and who decides when prayers get answered. Well, when asked this same question, Jesus said, "Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Yea, even before you ask, it will be answered." You need to accept the enormous truth of those statements. It's a metaphysical reality. Before you will have asked, God will have answered you. This is because the answer already exists in ultimate reality, and that's because you created it by thinking about it. And creation and manifestation take place in the same instant. This is so because there's only one instant. That is to say, time as a linear expression does not exist. This gets back to question one, which is answered thoroughly in CWG 2. Now, since your prayer has already been answered, the correct prayer is never a prayer of supplication, but always a prayer of thanksgiving. Did you get that, Marge? Okay, now here comes the big bomber. Here's the direct answer to your inquiry. The degree to which you accept and believe that your prayer has already been answered creates the degree to which you experience the answer as having been made manifest in your present reality. In other words, in the I Am paradigm, should you have the consciousness of a Christ, you would experience immediate results. Jesus is far from the only person, incidentally, who's seen his will made manifest in physical form in the instant that his will became known. Others have accomplished this. See Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, or study the life of Sai Baba. Many avatars and masters have produced instant results, instant healings, instant answers to prayers. Sometimes there's the question of whether each part of your three-part being is in harmony and in agreement about a thing. And that has much to do with how quickly and how successfully you place an experience in your reality, or, if you will, have a prayer answered by God. Now, as to question three, Marge, on Job, I don't know whether the book of Job was made up or not, but I suspect it's not entirely factual. It seems as though a very well-meaning person put that down on paper in order to show the power of faith and the promise of patience in the face of endless suffering. On the other hand, there may have been a man named Job, and he may really have had endless troubles, and the account may have been the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But the far more interesting part of your question seems to be the second part. Did he draw the misery to himself? If it did happen, did he create it all? The answer, of course, is yes. At some level, all of us are creating every single moment which we are experiencing, including, by the way, your having written and my having answered this question. Now, some things we create at a conscious level, and some things we create at a subconscious level, making it seem as though we didn't create them at all. Some things we solely create, and some things we co-create. And some things we create in concert with many, many others through the device known as collective consciousness. But all the time, we are creating. The question is not, are we creating this? The question isn't even, why are we creating this? The only question of importance is, who am I now in the face of this creation? For all of creation exists as an arena within which we are invited, encouraged, and have ourselves been created to answer that question. The process by which we create things, events, occurrences, opportunities, outcomes, and so forth, is far too complex to go into here, and is explained in extraordinary detail in CWG Book 1. Those sections of that book deserve close reading. Now, Marge, you ask me in your fourth question, what books or verses of the Bible are true? You know, I'm unable to sit here and review book by book, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, which portions of the Bible are true and which are false. Obviously, it's all true for some people and all false for others, and a little bit of both, I guess, for most. It's important to understand, Marge, that nothing is true unless you understand the word. That is to say, objective truth does not exist in the universe. The only truth is subjective reality, in other words, what you and I perceive. That's because whatever we observe in the so-called objective universe is affected by our observation of it. I realize that I'm getting into quantum physics here, and perhaps more deeply into this question than you wanted to go, but it's vital for you to add this to your comprehension if you're ever to find peace in your soul. True truth does not exist. That's because even at the God level, especially at the God level, we're making it all up. For more on this, read a wonderful book called The Universe is a Green Dragon by Brian Schwimm. Now, Marge, the question isn't which verses of the Bible are true. The question is which verses are true for you. I find great truth in the Bible, and enormous wisdom, incredible insight, really, all over the place. There are also some places where I cringe and find that the Bible does not speak to me at all. The same has been said, incidentally, about conversations with God, which is good, which is wonderful. I would hate to have produced a book with which everyone agreed down to the last word. Can you imagine the responsibility of that? No, I'd much rather have you be responsible for what you find there. That's as it should be. It's the same, obviously, with the Bible. Now let's get to your sex question. I see no contradiction in God's message in CWG regarding sex. Nowhere does the book call for irresponsible sexuality. Yet somewhere in some people's minds, God's injunction to have fun with sex, to engage in sex as often as you like, to see and experience and share the joy in it, to play with this wonderful gift, as the book so directly puts it, somehow these encouragements are seen as licenses to act irresponsibly. No one suggested anything of the sort. Those connections between fun, joy, play, and irresponsibility are connections you have made in your own mind. Someone has told you, obviously, that to have fun, to participate in sex joyfully, to play with sex is, or inevitably leads to, irresponsible behavior. See, I'm unwilling to make that connection. Certainly not automatically, which your question suggests. Your question suggests that the connection is automatic, that the outcome is automatic, that one thing leads to another, rather than that one thing could lead to another, which is quite a different thing. It is precisely this teaching, that joyful, playful, outrageous sexuality and full, rich sexual expression lead inevitably to irresponsible behavior, which has thrown most of the world, and decidedly most of the Western world, into its chronic paranoia about sex. A paranoia, incidentally, which has produced mass and massive guilt around the one aspect of humanness around which there was supposed to be no guilt. The human sexual response is a joy, a gift, a twinkle in the eye, celebration of life itself. It was never meant to be covered up, stowed away, kept out of sight, never talked about in polite company without embarrassment, and never actually engaged in without uptightness, shame, tentativeness at best. It was meant to be engaged in lovingly, openly, honestly, laughingly, joyfully, uninhibitedly, and with outrageous happiness. Notice that nowhere does it say irresponsibly. Nor are love, openness, honesty, laughter, joy, uninhibitedness, or outrageous happiness synonyms for irresponsibility. The book spoke of the joy and freedom and happiness of sex in that context, and assumed that the reader understood that one thing does not equal another. As to when, at what age, a child should begin to enjoy sexuality, the answer is immediately. In fact, the child does, almost immediately. It is we, uptight adults, who tell children, even infants, not to touch there, not to look there, not even to notice that there exists. It's we, uptight adults, who overlay our guilt, our shame, our embarrassment, our sexual dilemmas, and our dysfunctions on the child. The child has no sexual dilemma. The child has no sexual dysfunction. It's only after listening to and observing adults that the child begins to pick up signals that something is wrong about sex, that we shouldn't even say penis, for heaven's sake, or vagina. And so we make up all sorts of cutesy little words for the two-year-old to hear and use, lest, God forbid, the child actually use the right word. Is it any wonder our society is so twisted around its sexual attitudes that we can't even let our kids say penis? Is it any wonder that the world uses, as its most demeaning expletive, a four-letter word which just happens to describe one of the most extraordinary physical experiences of which humans are capable? So my answer to your question, Marge, is the answer that you may not want to hear. There's no time that's too early for children to experience, with joy, their sexuality. This does not mean intercourse, obviously. This means noticing, honoring, and celebrating that we're all human beings, mommy and daddy included, and that sexuality is a joyful, not an embarrassing and shameful, part of our humanness. There are ways in which the stomach quivering, heart-pounding, mind-blowing, wonderfully exciting experience of discovery of self and another may be encouraged, nurtured, created, and allowed, while remaining totally within the boundaries of age appropriateness, honesty, love of self and others, integrity, responsibility, and the celebration of life. Regretfully, Marge, most parents have not looked for such ways. Most cultures have not even tried. Don't you think it's time we did? When children are encouraged to express and experience the joy of their sexuality, and the sexuality of all human beings, in age-appropriate ways, their participation in that experience occurs at an age-appropriate time, which time is different, Marge, for every young person. Their fullest participation may not occur until they're 90, for it is part of the mystery and of the endless attraction of this experience that we can discover new beauty, new wonder, new openness, new vulnerability, new trust, new joy, new playfulness, and new depths of love, and the ability to share love, even as we grow older. But not, but never, Marge, if we start from shame, guilt, and embarrassment.
Dear Mr. Walsh, I just finished CWG Book 1 on Amtrak, returning from New York City. Thank you and God for the book. This will not be the only time it gets read. Your conversations are a confirmation of ideas I have held on to for years. It's so good to see them written out clearly for all to digest. A few questions. Did you ask God about Christmas? How should we celebrate differently from the way we celebrate today? How to spread CWG to others? Is a condensation of key points available as a low-cost tract? How can we communicate with others in this or any other universe? How can we bridge language and prejudice gaps? How can people think past their immediate circumstance? How can we tell what risks are worth taking? Sincerely, Marshall, Mechanicville, New York.
Dear Marshall, about Christmas. No, I didn't bring that up in my conversation with God, but I do have one comment. You ask, how should it be celebrated differently? CWG says there are no shoulds or shouldn'ts in God's world, so I imagine God would say, celebrate it any way you wish. It all depends on what you choose to experience, how you see yourself, what statement you're using your life to make about you. You see, everything we do is a statement about ourselves, including how or whether we celebrate Christmas. Now to your other questions. How to spread CWG to others? Don't know. But whatever you do, be sure you don't do anything too slick. Is a condensation of key points available as a low-cost tract? Yes, there are two booklets available, Bringers of the Light and Recreating Yourself, which condense and crystallize the main points in CWG that can be ordered from the Foundation. How can we communicate with others in this or any other universe? Communication is simple. Just think about it. I mean that literally. Just think about what you wish to communicate. Think of the message and think of the person to whom you wish to send it. If that person is not now in physical form, that is to say, if they are what you would call dead, they'll get the message immediately. If they're in the body, they may have a somewhat more difficult time receiving the data, depending upon the denseness of their environment, including their spiritual surroundings, beliefs, fears, and so forth. And if they are in physical form anyway, why not just talk to them out loud? How can we bridge language and prejudice gaps? By understanding, accepting, and implementing the highest truth. We are all one. The world would change tomorrow if we all simply held that reality. It's our thought of separation from each other and from God which creates all of our misery, all of our pain, all of our anguish, all of our loneliness and suffering, and, by the way, all of our righteousness. How can people think past their immediate circumstances? By having no attachment to results. When you don't fret about outcome, you don't fret about what's going on. You see that? It's really simple. You see your life in a larger context. You see your purpose in a larger way. You then recontextualize your present experience. You quite literally transform it. You no longer see it as problematical. And when you no longer see it that way, it ceases to be that way. You have risen above. You have transcended. How can we tell what risks are worth taking? Well, if we could tell that, there'd be no more risks, wouldn't there? See, life's an adventure. You want guarantees, you're in the wrong game. Yet there is a way to get what you desire, and that is to always desire what you get. That is wisdom. That is mastery. Conversations with God outlines in great detail the process by which we can all create whatever we choose. That process works. It'll be very effective for you, unless it isn't. See, each of us is evolving, becoming. Sometimes we use the process of creation so forcefully, so effectively, we startle ourselves. And sometimes we can't seem to place into manifestation what we desire, no matter how hard we try. There are many factors at play. There are many complexities involved. Reread CWG. It explains all of that. And when it comes to taking risks, remember those wonderful words from the French poet and philosopher Apollinaire, which appeared in CWG. Come to the edge. We can't. We're afraid. Come to the edge. We can't. We'll fall. Come to the edge. And they came. And he pushed them. And they flew. Someone once said, call your fears adventure. I like that. For many years now, I have sought to walk a spiritual path. It has not been easy. What should have been easy, what by rights ought to have been easy, I mean, shouldn't getting to God be the easiest thing of all, turned out to be very difficult, until recently. I see now that this was because, for most of those years, I was not clear on where my spiritual path was. Still, I knew I wanted to be on some kind of path, so I walked a path laid out for me by others. Only recently have I decided to follow the path of my heart. Only recently have I come to understand that it is okay to do so. That was a great revelation. It was life-changing. God wasn't going to get mad at me if I made a mistake, got it wrong, went astray, missed the boat. I wasn't going to burn in the everlasting fires of hell if I failed to discover and adopt the one true religion, worshipped improperly, or didn't worship at all. What is it like to walk the spiritual path? Look to your own life to find the answer. You've been walking the spiritual path since you were born, since before you were born. There's no way not to be walking the spiritual path because there is no other path to walk. All of life is spiritual, and every step you take is a step on the spiritual path. You are a spiritual being, and everything you think, say, and do is a spiritual event. Did you hear what I said? I said everything you think, say, and do is a spiritual event. So where will your path take you today? Wherever that is, I'm sure it will be a great adventure. Life is a lot of things, but it's rarely boring.
Dear Neil, I feel very frustrated. I feel very confused. Is God the God of the Bible, vengeful, judgmental, vindictive, or is he the God of your books? Couldn't care less about your daily existence, just go out and play. I feel broken. I feel alone. I've prayed all my life and never felt his presence or response. I've run the gamut of praying for things up to what I need now, peace within myself. I've read the Bible, I've cried, I've begged, I've screamed, I've been angry, all to no avail. I've given up. I've asked him in Jesus' name to take over my life. I've told him how very tired I am. All to no avail. I paid $150 for a mantra, $250 for a psychiatrist. Nothing. I've tried to meditate for years, but can never quiet my thoughts, ever. My self-disgust is growing stronger and stronger. I have no idea why I wrote this. I'm still seeking, seeking, seeking. M.M., Silverthorn, Colorado.
Well, M.M., it sounds like you're exactly where I was when I started having my conversations with God. That's super. There's no better place to be than fed up. That's the place of new beginnings. That's the place of letting go. That's the place of giving up. You are giving up what's been going on for so long and now getting ready to create a new reality. I know what you're going through right now, Em, and what you've been going through these many years. Now, just as you are giving up everything, there's one thing more I'd like you to give up, my friend. Then you'll be totally ready. I'd like you to give up your idea that you can't find an answer. I'm here to tell you that you can. God will never let you down. And if you have not received any response from God before, it's not because he hasn't answered. It's because, like me, you've been unable to hear the response. But trust me, God is responding right now and every day and moment of your life. I'd like to take a look here at how you have characterized God, though, because I think you've got her all wrong. You've paraphrased CWG1 to say that God couldn't care less about your daily experience and just wants you to go out and play. That would be a mischaracterization, Em, and I don't want you to hang out with that. God does care about your experience. God simply doesn't care how you go about creating it. Imagine this. Think of loving parents watching their children at play in the backyard. They don't care whether their children play tag or hide-and-seek. It matters not to them what games are invented, but they do care about whether the children are safe and having a good time. So they make sure the yard is safe. And if the children get hurt and called out for help, the parents are right there running out to the yard to see what's up to make everything better. It's not so very different with God. She gives us the toys with which to fashion the most wonderful games, read that, life, and a safe place in which to play. Then he leaves us alone to have our own experience and has absolutely no preference whether we play tag or hide and seek. But if we call for help, God is there, right there, to make everything better. Now, that's not someone who doesn't care about our daily experience. That's someone who loves us enough to give us our freedom to do as we wish and promises to be there for us whenever we need him. Sounds like a pretty neat God to me. So now, call on God to answer you. Ask God to show you a sign, give you some help, provide you with some special insight that might help you now. But be on the lookout. Her response may come in a form other than the one you're expecting. It could be the lyrics to the next song you hear, the storyline of the next movie you see, the text of the next book that falls into your hands. It could be the chance utterance of a friend on the street, or a thought that comes to you in the middle of the night. So watch, look, listen, for you do not know the hour nor the form in which God will come with your word of encouragement.
Dear Mr. Walsh, is there any way one can speed up this process of enlightenment, for example, a Cliff Notes shortcut or the use of the powerful I Am commands? Steve, Saline, Michigan.
Dear Steve, the fastest way I know to speed up the process of enlightenment is to begin to seriously conjure the grandest version of the greatest vision ever you held about who you are and about yourself. What does that look like? How would you dress? What would you eat? Where would you go? Who would you hang out with? What things would you do or not do? What would you say? See, get very specific here. In your highest idea about yourself, what are the answers to those questions? Write them down. Take pages, if you have to explain yourself to yourself. Then, once you've got that picture drawn, step into it. Wear the clothes, do the things, say the words. This is where the I am command comes in. And do, say, and think nothing else. This will seem presumptuous at first, because believe me, your highest idea about yourself is pretty high, and most people all around you will probably wonder, what in the name of Sam Hill you're doing? Ignore them, forget them, they know not of who you are. But remember this, should you move into the